Welcome everyone to the first day of Sufi Camp, Spring 2009. If you can't hear me at any point, please just ask me to speak up. I'm happy to do that. Would you like to move your desk here? You can do that and be in the circle. Did you bring a little writing desk with you? What a nice little setup, isn't it? What a good student. He's ready to go.
I was going to say, this makes me feel like a real student.
It is. Well, we are all real students, inshallah. I think often we all think we're the teachers, and then we have nothing to learn, right? We have to be receptive. I'm going to play this Tibetan bowl. It's a singing bowl. It's also known as a medicine bowl. It's made with different metals, and the different metals are intended to harmonize different parts, subtle parts of our being. In the Tibetan healing arts, it's actually used for healing, that it's used to either draw vibrations into the body for healing or extract disharmonious vibrations out of the body. So they use these physically, as well as mixing medicines and herbal compounds in them. There are special properties that come through the metals into foods and these substances that are very healing for the body. And so it's really quite extraordinary. So listen to the sound. I hope that you feel its harmonious vibration and just allow it to come into your being. Listen to the sound of the bell. You know, we have this sound everywhere. In schoolhouses, they ring the bell. In the steeples of the churches, they ring the bell. In the temples, they ring the bell. Wherever you go, it's a call. It's a call to prayer. So let this be our call to prayer. And also at this time, let an invocation arise in your heart, invoking the presence of the holy ones that have inspired you, that inspire you and cause you to aspire. We can invite them to be here with us, to guide us, to illuminate us, to shelter us, to protect us, to lift us up. Feel the breath consciously moving into your body. Let it fill every cell of your being with life and light and love. Thank you. eyes and let's face towards the east. We might have to go around these, and we can make kind of an arc, and we'll say the invocation that we just heard and the morning prayer.
Judge and forgiver of our shortcomings, Lord God, take flight, that we're taking flight, this gesture is very important.
Further into the circle. Tune further with the breath, and I'm so glad you're taking notes. Feel free to do that. And some people say, oh, no need for notes, but yes, when we're students, sometimes we have to take those notes so that we can practice. It's good. You should also know that the audio files will be uploaded to a website, which can be downloaded as MP3s, and you can listen to them directly through your speakers on your computer, or you can put them on iPods, so they're available. And we have the website, and we can talk more about that. So that and many other teachings actually are available. We try to keep a list of not only myself, Piero Murshid Hadayat and Ayat Khan, and others are there as well. This is the practice that was given by Hazrat and Ayat Khan called the purification breaths. These breaths have been disseminated in a number of forms. And that's all right. Whatever, some of us drive Chevys, or some of us drive Hondas, or some of us drive BMWs or Mercedes or whatever. Whatever the technology is that gets you there, if you have faith in it, it will get you there. Here, my aim is to offer the teachings as they were given by Hazrat and Ayat Khan. And I'd like to just read a little bit of what he says of this practice. Many of you have done it with me. But it's a way of tuning, and then we'll listen to this beautiful teaching of Murshid's. He says, this is done before breakfast, which is good. Have you eaten yet? I actually had a nibble. And he says, it's typically done standing in a relaxed manner. I think today we'll do it sitting so it's not too much up and down for us. The feet are stable on the ground. The knees and the shoulders and the neck and the jaws are relaxed. He says inhalations and exhalations are done in a rhythmic, restful manner, quietly. So when the breath is, while it is full, it's also somewhat subtle. You know, sometimes we hear people breathing next to us. Here, it's intended to be more subtle. And here, this is, I think, it's a jewel that maybe is overlooked, but I'll point it out. He says, it is important to discover the natural rhythm of one's breath. And why is it important? Does anyone know? Question and answer. I ask the question, you answer.
The breath is the unity is the oneness comes through the breath. It's the what unites all beings, what unites nature breathes, the earth breathes. So Jesus said, Allah Ruhau, the unity of breath. So that's, we try to imagine all these other words, spirit and Lord and God, but really it's the breath, it's life, it's the unity of breath.
That's true. That's true, but why is it important that we discover one's own natural rhythm?
You can only find harmony by first harmonizing with your own rhythm and then spreading from there.
That's true. And anything else? Yes.
If I'm sensitive to my breath, then I can tell when I've done the breaths, that I can tell if they're refined or not.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I think that's important.
Yeah. Dalai Lama, he says to us, what is most important is what happens off the cushion. In other words, the meditation, the practice happens on the cushion, but when we get up and out in the world. So see, if we understand our natural rhythm, we can understand, first of all, when we're out of rhythm, right? We can also understand when that rhythm is altered by our environment or other people. You understand? It's very important. If I'm up here and I'm going, you know, you all of a sudden start to feel a little anxious or like, God, what's wrong with her? Is she going to hyperventilate? But if you see, and we can also then offer the benefit of this breath, this rhythm to others. And there's a time when we must be excited and get something done. And there's a time when we also need to relax and be restful. Anayat Khan in the Gathas talks about being that, he said, he makes an analogy to people as notes on the piano. And he says, it isn't the fault of one key to the other that they don't sound harmonious together. You see, this is also true of people. But he said, the keynote is the note to which all other notes are tuned. So if we understand the rhythm of our breath, if we can have mastery and control of our breath, we cannot control the whole world. Musa's correct. But we can control ourselves. And in another paper, I may have brought it, but I didn't plan on offering it. Or maybe it's in this book on character building. Anayat Khan talks about the great significance of developing willpower. So when we can become that note, that keynote, then other notes actually can become tuned to that note. Can I highlight it with a reading here? This is a little book that's just been republished. It was out of print for a long time. They've published it in Europe. It's called The Flower Garden of Anayat. And one of his very close disciples, one of the first ones actually in Holland, he and his wife had the first gathering for Hazrat Anayat Khan in The Hague. And the wife was she was a very famous children's book illustrator, so she did these beautiful illustrations of Anayat Khan, and then their selected teachings of Anayat Khan there. And she was also one of his music students. So if you visit the site, you'll see the instruments that she learned to play, the veenas and the tamburas that she learned her music on from Hazrat Anayat Khan. Now let's see. So again, having to do with the breath. Listen to this. The ears of whose heart have listened to the word of God, but also to the breath of God, the Ruh Allah, have first accomplished stillness in their life. You know, this is like a still pond. It reflects everything, right? When the heart is still, when the inner atmosphere, we may be very active, but when the inner atmosphere is still, there's a clear reflection. The heart, the ears of whose heart have listened to the word of God and have first accomplished stillness in their life. And what an atmosphere such persons can produce. What effect their presence has. It is more than healing, more than medicine. A man with a perfectly stilled and comforted and rested mind will at once raise up another who is going through distress or restlessness or pains or ill temper or worry or anxiety. The very presence of one whose mind is stilled gives such hope, such inspiration, such sympathy, such power and life. All the heavenly properties run so smoothly and freely from the person whose mind has his words, his voice, his presence, all react on the minds of others. And as he stills his mind, so his very presence becomes healing. And so with the breath, this is how we can accomplish this. And this is why Murshid says here, it is important to discover the natural rhythm of one's breath. While inhaling, these are the instructions now, while inhaling and exhaling, one's thoughts are focused on receiving and radiating divine power in space, which purifies and revivifies, and which inspires and enables the soul to unfold. It's like these wings. It enables the soul to unfold. The heart and wings, we see that symbol. He says, if one is ill or feeling weak, this exercise can be done sitting or even lying down. In the case of delicate breathing organs or any other internal problem, or if required for the purpose of improving the health, this practice is done twice a day, usually once a day in the morning. An icon talks about the benefit of breath work in the morning, along with prayer. In the evening, it's more for contemplation and meditation. The breath work, I always consider it a kind of inner yoga. You know, it's kind of massaging the inner organs. It's opening, if you've studied it all, again, Eastern medicine. There are all these subtle channels that run through the body. I know Mary Angela knows about this from her yoga kundalini practices, but there are these very subtle channels that move the energy through the body. You know, it's this beautiful network, you know. It's like the inside of a great CPU, you know, integrated circuitry. But the organs need to be exercised as well as the external muscles, and the breath is one of the things that can do that. So he says, again, if for the purpose of improving the health, this practice is done twice a day, morning and evening, or even three times a day. And he says this, which I think is very important. He says the exercise is the basis of many esoteric exercises and should be mastered before you can understand further mysteries. So here's the basic practice, and he's giving us the key. In another paper, he says, while we're breathing in, I inhale divine light and life. He said to also consider that you're absorbing love from the atmosphere, but we don't repeat that part of the phrase. And then we breathe out, I radiate, then the phase changes, life and light. We breathe in light, very subtle, life, then we turn it, life, light, when we give it out. So anyone, again, that studied Tibetan Buddhism, Tonglen, the act of taking on and giving back, this is, I know Murshid had to study Tibetan Buddhism. There's some esoteric papers that are for the healing concentration, and he gives the mantras that are very secret mantras that you could not know if you hadn't studied Tibetan Buddhism. So this receiving and giving is very much this practice, anyone that studied that. Some of you have done it, I know. We've talked about it as well. There are 20 breaths, and the breath moves in different directions with each cycle of five. Again, in other papers, he talks about the significance of being able to, at will, move the breath in different directions. This is all actually leading up, I'll give you one of the mysteries, when people are working in healing, in Sufi healing, I'm not talking about any other form, there are concentrations about being able to direct the breath to a part of the body that needs that healing, even at great distance. We can't do that if we're not masters of the breath. And some of you have participated in the absentee healing service, and you know you follow the vibration of the individual through the line of the breath and the vibration. So again, if you could sit in a relaxed manner but somewhat attentive, that would be very good. Typically, the concentration is held just at the tip of the nose. There we see a ball of light, white light, And this is the prana, and we absorb that in as we inhale. And then we exhale again, concentrating on that object. We're inhaling through the nose, and we're exhaling through the nose in this breath. So when we inhale, we repeat the phrase, I inhale divine light and life. And when we breathe out, I exhale divine life and light. And remember, he gives us the instruction, the breath is rather full, yet relaxed and subtle. The breath changes. We breathe in the nose and out the mouth. The line of direction of breath is downward, obviously. And repeat the phrase inwardly while breathing in. I inhale divine light and life. And as we breathe out, I radiate divine life and light. In the nose and out the mouth. Changes its direction yet again. The breath is in the mouth and out the nose in a rising direction, yet keeping the concentration at the tip of the nose, an orb of light which is absorbed in the breath and radiated. And one might consider that every cell is like a solar collector that's gathering life, light, and love, and then radiating it. You know, it's like this, we're charging the battery. And then we radiate it. We don't throw it out, we just radiate it. So, in the mouth and out the nose, I inhale divine light and life. I radiate divine life and light. And now the breath changes again, and the breath is in the mouth and out the mouth. The sense of this is that the breath is moving in a zigzag upward motion, but most important is just to do the breath in a relaxed way, trying to discover one's own natural rhythm in the mouth and out the mouth, while repeating inwardly the phrase, I inhale divine light and life, I radiate divine life and light. The breath returns to in the nose and out the nose, and we say inwardly, and I'll repeat the words to the Nyas, it's the healing prayer. And so while we breathe in, you repeat the words, Beloved Lord, Almighty God, and breathe out. Through the rays of the sun, and breathe in. Through the waves of the air, and breathe out. Through the all-pervading life and space, and breathe in. Purify and revivify me. Hold your breath, and I pray, and release, breathe out. Heal my body, heart, and soul. Breathe in, beloved Lord, Almighty God, and out through the rays of the sun. And breathe in through the waves of the air. And out through the all-pervading life and space. Breathe in, purify and revivify me, hold your breath, and I pray and release, heal my body, heart, and soul. And one more time, beloved Lord, Almighty God, through the rays of the sun, through the waves of the air, through the all-pervading life and space, purify and revivify me, hold your breath, and I pray, out, heal my body, heart, and soul. Notice your breath. Notice your interior atmosphere. Thank you. this little book titled Universal Sufism, The Path of Breath, Prayer, and Zikr. Hazrat Inayat Khan says, a mystic becomes capable of sending breath to any part of his body. You see, this is why we have to concentrate on these different directions. Thus, he is able to send light, radiance, and magnetism to any particle of his body. The question, does he send the breath by his power of will, can simply be answered by yes. He says we practice this development of willpower by, he gives the example of the grapes being on the table. And how, those grapes look so good. I think I'll have a few grapes. But just telling oneself no, to refuse oneself, little things like that helps to develop the willpower. You know, I'm a great fan of psychology, and yet sometimes it gives people a lot of permission to be big babies. You know? I do it because it feels good. Path of the mystic may be just a bit different. It's up to each person. And we will soon see that from this teaching on the Sufi point of view. I feel so much as if these are great treasures. You know that Hazrat Inayat Khan left the earth on February 5th. 1927. This teaching was given a few months before that, July 16th, 1926. In one of the papers that I'll be reading, Things to Remember Day After Tomorrow, there are indications there, the way he spoke to his students, that he knew he was leaving and not returning. So you can imagine that these teachings were very magnetized. They were kind of the last instructions. And they're not published. That might be a project. For some reason, Hazrat Inayat Khan wanted this noted that it was given on a Friday or day off. Now I'd like to say a few words on the idea of the Sufi point of view. It differs very much from the general point of view. It is not because of its difference from the others, but because of its profoundness. In the case of dealing with people, treating people, in whatever way one has to treat them, the first thing the Sufi thinks is, in what way must I spare the person's susceptibilities? How can I avoid bringing the person displeasure by avoiding in saying a word or by avoiding in doing something? Now here's the thing. Listen to this next phrase. How can I say it to someone without saying something that will hurt the person? How can I say it to someone? So you have to find a way, but not so direct, you see. Now, if they're a little bit wooden noggin, you have to be sometimes direct. How can I act that it will not hurt or it will not touch the person wrongly? In other words, it is a delicate point of view to think delicately. And what is the generality, and it is what the generality overlooks. It's not simple to be thoughtful. It is not easy to be considerate. It requires a great deal of delicacy, skill. One must know the art of approaching another. You know, sometimes you have to, if one can find a way of saying things to someone in a way that then sooner or later they adopt it as their own ideal or idea, that's very empowering to them. Is he suggesting this here? And the other point of view of the Sufi is still more difficult. And that is to maintain sincerity, to maintain faithfulness, to maintain truth. False flattery, polished politeness, made-up refinement, these things are against the Sufi's idea. And therefore, on the one hand, he must be extremely fine and polite and delicate. And on the other hand, he may not prove to his conscience in a way insincere and external and superficial. Very often, there are some sincere people. But with their sincerity, there is an abruptness. You will find many people saying, well, I tell the truth. If it cannot agree with them, it shows that they cannot digest it. Their digestive power is not great. And a person very proudly says that, I've given him a good talk, and he feels that I'm quite sincere. But sincerity has no value without fineness. You've had this happen, yes? Perhaps we've also done it. We understand. Thank you. Tom, if you need to read this later, you know I have it with me. If one overlooks the law of fineness, of gentleness, and one wishes to be very truthful, that is an unbalanced condition. On one side, fineness. On the other side, sincerity makes a balance in life. See, again, here's the indication that we must know the rhythm of our breath. To thine own self be true. Last statement again. But sincerity has no value without fineness. If one overlooks the law of fineness, of gentleness, and one wishes to be truthful, that is an unbalanced condition. In other words, here I think he's talking about someone that can be very harsh. And we see that. We have people that are with all the best intentions, but they feel very righteous, sometimes self-righteous. And then they deliver that as if their way is the only way, right? I mean, we know that. We've experienced it perhaps in school, perhaps from family members, friends, community members. We see this. And there's that very, there's kind of a harshness about it. There's not a fineness or a delicateness. But he says, on the other side, fineness on the other side, on one side is fineness, on the other side, sincerity. Make a balance in life. I'll tell you one of my great examples, and perhaps you have, I hope you have one in your own life, is Piramersha Hidayatnayak Khan. He always plants the seed by asking a question, which empowers someone to respond and sort of take up the mantle, you know? Instead of saying, do this, well, don't you think it would be nice if we did blah, blah, blah? You know, it's a nice way of saying something. There's a fineness there. And I've also heard him say things in a way that's, you know, I would say, well, it's a little bit of circular thinking, but, you know, he takes people around like that, like a little pony sometimes to get them to where, you know, kind of get to the target. But it's a very delicate way. And you know, what I'm discovering more and more, at least for myself, my rhythm is very fast. I come to conclusions very quickly. I make decisions very quickly. Not everyone does that. And if I don't understand that, I can become very impatient and I can become intolerant That's my problem, not someone else's problem. But understanding that and having the patience and working with the breath and saying, well, you know, I'll just be that little hare waiting at the finish line. You know, everybody get to it. It's okay. You know what I mean? Right? It's like... And then pretty soon, they're there and they've come to that same conclusion. But had I have told them that, wouldn't have bowed very well. Do you understand what I'm saying? So it's like falling in love. People fall in love at different paces. And if one partner is like way ahead, it scares somebody off. Or you see, there has to be an understanding there and accommodation. I like to call it the Kenny Rogers mentality of spirituality, knowing when to hold it, knowing when to fold it, and knowing when to walk away. So it's a little bit, it's not as nice as an icon saying it here, but it's kind of like...
The Nuria Papers.
That's right, the Nuria Papers. Yeah, and these will be out on the international airwaves soon.
Comes from a lot of places.
It does, doesn't it? It does. And if you're hearing it, you can get it anywhere. Absolutely. Another Sufi attitude is to the resignation of the past. To be attentive to the present, to be hopeful for the future. What is done is done. What is the use of grieving over it? It is the past. It's gone. Turn your back to it and forget it. Again, willpower. It's training the mind. Get it on the track, get it on the track, get it on the track. And what is being done, be attentive to it wholeheartedly, to the moment. Be in the present, be in the moment. Give your whole being to make it good. And what is to come? Be hopeful towards it. In that way, a person is able to have the Sufi attitude. Sufism teaches tolerance. But by tolerance, does it mean that we defend the wrongdoer? By tolerance, it means the Sufi spares himself from judging someone whom he has not, who he does not know. Whether the person is in the right or in the wrong, to judge whether a person is right or wrong, let him go. That is the attitude. It is not the attitude of indifference, but very often by judging people, you spoil people. As soon as you accuse a person of wrongdoing, you throw him down deeper. You know, people get more stubborn about things. I am right. I'll show you. If you let him loose, his wrongdoing will become his greatest teacher. Again, it requires some patience. By interfering with that teaching which a person is getting in life, a person spoils the other person's life. That is intolerance. Besides, one is never sure whether a person is in the wrong or right. What is right, and he says that in another teaching. What is right for one is wrong for another. What is wrong for one is right for another. We've talked about that, some of us, and I know we've had greater discussions in other summer schools about this idea of talking about practices. People will confuse themselves. Well, my teacher told me to do blah, 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 and my teacher told me to do blah, blah, blah. And somewhere Merschitz talks about it. I don't know if he gives an example of tea, but I like using chocolate, you know. Like I may see to say to someone, you must eat a lot of chocolate. It's really very good for you. And for another person, I say, you can't eat any chocolate. It's not very good for you. But if these two people start talking, they'll think, well, was Nuri's crazy? She's given us two completely different instructions. You see what I'm saying? There's value here. If one cannot see from the point of view of others, one does not know what is hidden behind it. Reason can take so far and no further. So our reason, our rational mind, can't always know everything. It takes insight. For himself, his standard of right and wrong is what he thinks is to be right and wrong for the moment. But by that standard, he does not judge others. He says, maybe they have their own standard according to their particular evolution. I'm not the person to judge it. People might misunderstand a Sufi owing to this, because either people are without a rule or they are slaves of the rule. And there are very few who take the rule for their use without being its slave. Who make a rule and who use the rule and yet are not restricted by it. So there has to be a standard, but things are situational. There has to be a standard, but things are situational. I mean, we might say, oh, that person, they're a terrible thief, they went and they stole a loaf of bread. But if they have no capacity to feed their families, perhaps that's the only way. Then we say, well, that's wrong, that's the law, that's the rule. But they have another power they're answering to, an accountability to their family to feed them. So you see, this is a small example, but we understand it through that. And now comes Sufi's religion. The religion of the Sufi is one, and that is to prove to his conscience true. And having dealt with everyone who comes in contact with him kindly, not for his disadvantage or for the disadvantage of his own, but kindly as far as life can allow him to be kind, because kindness has no limit. There can be very little things which you can call kindness, and there can be great things which you can call kindness. Mother Teresa says, I don't seek to do great things, I seek to do small things with great love. There is the story of Ruhela. Ruhela, I'm not reading that part of this. This is not so significant, but I want to go down here. Well, I'll read it. It's only one paragraph. There is a story of Ruhela. Ruhela is a sect of mountain people. One Ruhela was traveling in the same railroad compartment with Brahmins, priestly caste, and he was trying to understand the Hindustani language. The Brahmins were speaking about kindness, so Ruhela wondered what kindness was. The Brahmins all the time used the word kindness, so he asked, what do you mean by kindness? They said, kindness? What? Do you not know? To be good to people, to be loving, to be sympathetic. He could not understand. He said, I cannot understand. Explain more. Merchant really had an interesting sense of humor, too. They tried and tried to explain more. Ah, yes, he said, now I understand. I was once kind. I was kind also once in my life. See the circular thinking? They were amused to see that he was kind once in his life. They asked, how were you kind? And he said, well, yes, I remember. One day in the war, I saw in the battlefield a horse in great torture. And I felt like this, just as you say. What did I do? Or what did you do, they asked. And he said, I took out my sword and I took off his head to relieve him. And that was his kindness. And to him, that was kindness. I mean, to me, actually, it would probably be kindness, too. But, you know, that's how he related to it, was in battle and this horse being tortured. Every person's conception of kindness is as far as he can feel. Here, this is an important phrase, I think. And this is evolutionary, I think, within us. And I think sometimes it has to do with courage and strength. Because when we have great courage and we have great strength, we allow ourselves to feel. And when we can feel, then we can feel kindness. Nevertheless, for the Sufi, there is one thing which he would rather like to avoid. And if there is any sin, it is that one thing which the Sufi would perhaps consider to be a sin. And what is it? It is to avoid unknown cruelty. Unknown cruelty. We have to be very mindful. We may be cruel without knowing it. unknown cruelty is that by inconsideration, by thoughtlessness, by the misuse of words, by thoughtless action, and by unconsciously sometimes a person gives pain or trouble or hurt or harm to another. And everybody hardly knows about it, hardly thinks about it. And yet he has done the harm just the same. It is such a delicate subject, and it requires such a great thought and consideration not to cause that harm. As the Buddha says, the essence of religion is harmlessness. It's interesting, he's quoting the Buddha again. Question. If someone asks what definite teaching the Sufi has to offer, answer, you must say that the Sufi has no definite teaching to offer. It is the essence of all teaching. Question. You said, you must not defend the wrongdoer. If we do not know, if we doubt, answer. If we have a doubt that he is a wrongdoer, the best thing is to not defend him. Why to defend? We might be taken as someone who promotes wrongdoing. Sometimes we think it is wrong what a person has done, and owing to our kindness, we are defending him. You see, there's not a good kindness. It's a twist there. And it's like defending something which we think wrong. Question. Can we defend the person without defending his action? Answer. It's so difficult to divide the person from their action. It's very difficult. Nevertheless, if you separate the person from his action and defend him, you may. Question. We have a saying, love the sinner but not the sin. Answer. That is very good, very wise. Question. Murshid, what is the best way to treat some person who has followed a wrong course of action, yet we know they thought they were doing right, and we do not want to be unfriendly to them, and yet, as you say, if we pay a particular attention to them, people think we're defending their action. And if we do not, and Christian-like, they turn their back and say we are condemning them. Answer, yes, if you're in that position, it is just as well to be silent. Silence is a great protection. Silence is a great protection. So you advise avoiding persons like that? Answer, yes. This is also true in Buddhism, they teach this. It's not judging, but also, you know, it's kind of the pot will absorb the flavor and smells of the things that are in it. Must be mindful. It's not to say that that can't be done, but one must be very masterful. In like the first with the reading from this little book, then we can change that vibration. We can offer something to balance it. Question, how could we help these people who are in the wrong way? Answer, they keep asking the same question. Do you kind of get that? Like, hello? You're that impatient. Come on, he already gave you the answer. Yeah, I see it. That's the first step. Answer. It's a very difficult question. You cannot always help them. There is some time that time helps them. Sometimes their own wrongdoing helps them. Now I'll tell you a little story of a man in the mosque. There was a good person, very pious person, and he was praying in the mosque. And there came a lad, a mischievous lad, and he entered the mosque. He saw that person devoted in his prayers, so he came up and he gave him a slap, a big blow on the back, and then he ran away. Of course, they are engaged in prayer, and they are asked not to go out when they're in prayer. Therefore, the pious man continued his prayer, and the boy ran away. But when the man came out, he saw the boy standing and laughing. So he put his hand in his purse and he gave him a penny. So the boy was very glad. But the next time, a soldier was offering his prayer. Of course, the soldier's mind was half on the prayer and half on his drill. When the boy came up and gave him a slap, the soldier was conscious of it. And as soon as he got up, he was ready to answer it, and he gave him a blow and threw him down. From that, the boy learned never to do it again. You see, here's now other something. He's telling us on the one hand, sometimes don't do something. Now he's telling us on the other hand, the soldier giving him a slap made him not do it again. The man that gave him the penny, oh, good little boy, here, you give it. He didn't, you know. That didn't help him. How can we know? From that, the boy never learned to never do it again. One blow was enough for him to finish. So by that action, this man prevented that boy from disturbing other people and the condition of the mosque. Both did something towards his improvement. The first was that he let him learn from his own devices. So he let him continue, and that he learned from his weakness. The second completed that teaching, completed the teaching. Therefore, we are not the only responsible ones to accomplish it. You see, sometimes we do a piece, and somebody else comes to complete it. Let another one come and complete it. Life will teach just the same. Why do we take the responsibility of the teaching? Yeah? I have a few more questions and answers. Do you have time? Okay. Question. Christ teaches us first to correct our own faults and mistakes. Would it not be a good plan to try and extend one's own self towards another, really feeling where the other person is and working from that bottom if they feel that he should do so? Influencing the other in a special manner? Answer, yes, but that is the work of the teacher. Capital T. Yes, but that is the work of the teacher. Capital T. When a person reaches the stage of teachership, then he may do it. But when we come to a general Sufi idea, what every Sufi must have, if that Sufi can have this point of view, which I've explained, that begins the Sufi life. Question. If one has received a dress, a beautiful dress, and one does not feel worthy to wear it, what would you advise to do? Answer. If it was the fashion of the day, I would wear it. Isn't that great? If it was the fashion of the day, I would wear it. It's about feeling worthy, too. Questions or comments? What did you learn? Anything? What will you remember through the day from the teaching?
It's a lot of different levels of one of the things that jumped out here, the self-righteousness, little flaws. They're really subtle with me sometimes. They really, you might not even notice them, and then I'll step back and I'll think, oh, I could have handled that one a little differently.
You know what I'm saying? Not a big disaster, but a minor one for sure. And those just loaded with those.
Yeah, and sometimes it's just going on in here or here. Do you know what I mean? And
it's the
like,
other problem.
You know, we can often deceive others, but can we deceive ourselves? That's the hard part. I was saying to a couple friends, sometimes I just think I could just take that little mind out and put it out on the night table like a set of dentures. You know what I mean? Sometimes just stop it. You know? Because it happens inwardly, too, whether we produce it as an outward action. Thank you, Charles, for saying that. Anything else?
I like remembering that the divine laws are going to correct a person for their mistakes.
Yeah.
It's not my responsibility to do that.
That's right. That's right. And sometimes it is, though. You know, as an example is, when I was living in India, I was having an issue with someone, and I was talking. It was very obvious to me that this person was making some very serious decisions that were not right, but that would have long-term ramifications that could be harmful. And I spoke to my teacher about that, my Tibetan Buddhist teacher, Komtul Rinpoche, and he said, you know, you have to let them do what they do, and just know that that their decisions will become evident to them if they're wrong, and be patient, that no doubt the person, if you continue on your course and they continue on theirs, through their own observation and analysis, they'll understand the difference of the outcome, and sooner or later, it's likely, rather than you imposing an opinion, they will come to ask for it. And then it will be of value to them. And you know, it has come to be true with that particular individual. It took a long time, but it happened. And now there's a very good relationship, and the person seems to be in more balance. That's good. That's a good teaching. Again, it's about my rhythm is quicker, where I see things, you know, I don't know, something happens and I can see that outcome quicker, perhaps. And some people have to experience things differently. That's mine. I have to learn that. Tolerance and patience. So sometimes we do have to do something. We do have a responsibility as well. Yeah. Yes?
I think I remember the soldier, that there's a time to support a person and there's a time to draw a line in the sand, but sometimes that's a two-person deal.
Yeah.
Because I saw just a teenager, maybe 16 or 17, took his dog to the vet, and it was a big dog whining and crying. And the boy was saying, oh, you're going to be okay, and all this, and the dog was getting worse. And all of a sudden, the boy grabbed a hold of his dog's neck and he said, get a grip. And the dog straightened up. And I thought, that young man's going to be a great father someday. Because he could move in two directions.
Yeah.
He just went, get a grip.
Yeah.
He wouldn't meet two people. Do the whole deal himself.
That's right.
Is the okay?
Yeah, the dog just
okay.
Stood right up and
yeah, I mean, it wasn't hadn't just gotten run over by a car or anything. Get a crap. He was just anxious. Yeah.
He was anxious.
Yeah. I like that. That's
yeah.
So when I grab somebody by the
sometimes you get a grip.
Anything else? Well, thank you for being here. Thank you for your interest in these teachings. If we're on the path, I would think that we would be interested in these teachings. But every season comes in its own way, yes.
Thank you for offering.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Shall we stand and say, we can hold hands. This say the Khatun together, just to close the circle.
Spirit, and unite us all in thy perfect being.